Well, Elizabeth, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today about yourself and the Quesnel Museum. Let's start with your background. How did you get involved with museums and how did you get involved with the Quesnel Museum?
Well, I did a BA in history and art history. Coming out of high school, I was interested in history and sort of had to make the decision between university and possibly a museum career, or I did a lots of arts and, you know, pottery and weaving and that kind of stuff. And looking at the time, I saw that I kind of wanted the experience of the university degree. And then the arts program was the same length as the museum studies program at U of T. So I thought, well, I'll do the BA and then, you know, go from there. So I did BA in history and art history at U of T. And then I ended up going to York and doing a master's in art history and museum studies. Then I've worked in community museums for, I guess it's over 30 years now. So I was in community museums around Ontario. And then I moved to Quesnel almost 13 years ago. And I've been running the museum here ever since.
And what was the history of the Quesnel Museum in terms of the collections? Where did they begin and how have they changed over the years with the mandate of the museum?
So we were one of those Historical Society Foundation collections. The Caribou Historical Society was formed 1951 around, you know, they were probably 90 years, approaching 100 years, and the pioneer families were starting to see the changes in the community, and they formed a heritage society and started collecting. The year they formed, the Boyd family that had operated the Cottonwood Ranch stopping house, and I mean, they'd been here since the 50s, but they'd operated that stopping house since probably the 1870s, sold the property. So one of the core foundational collections they got to go and pick from that site. So they collected, and the museum was built in 1963. So started with like a one room facility that was tourist bureau and museum. And then they had an addition in 72 and the city took over. And so we've been the Quesnel Museum ever since.
And of the collection, what would you say are some of the strengths that it has?
So we have a good, you know, representation of early pieces. And then because of, we got like the entire contents of this house, so we have quite a lot of kind of weird ephemera that people don't collect. And even from the beginning, Quesnel, from settlement period, had a really strong Chinese history, settlement history. And that was certainly represented in the early collection. Probably the First Nations would have been a little weaker. It was more lithic materials and that type of thing in the early collection, I would think.
What are some changes or events or individuals in the community at the moment that you feel eager to gather documentation about for the museum?
Right now, we're probably having another transition. That forestry became a thing. You know, we were originally a mining, well, supply center for mining. And then in the 50s, we became a major industrial center for all aspects of forestry. So we're going through a transition now with the changes in the forestry industry. Going back, though, to the idea of changes in how the museum has operated, in the probably about 2000, they did a strategic plan and identified that the museum was too Eurocentric. Since then, there's been a real effort to adopt or to broaden the scope, and we've done a lot of oral history projects. We did map funding and work and hired local First Nations and did lots of interviews with elders and collecting in that community, and also revisited the Chinese history. The two first professional photographers in Quesnel at the turn of the 20th century were both Chinese. So we redeveloped exhibits around C.D. Hoi and C.S. Wing and traveled the C.S. Wing exhibit. The C.D. Hoi exhibit, the photographs, negatives, are actually owned in Barkerville. Mm. So they created an exhibit and traveled it. And when it was finished, it came. And we've done a semi-permanent installation in Quesnel because that was his hometown. And then we did a similar show with the second photographer. And then we did a Chinese memorial project that came out of working with the Chinese consultation group in the community. In the Quesnel Pioneer Cemetery, there were a large number of people buried, but there were only about 5 tombstones. So we ended up doing a memorial cairn and doing interviews around who had been buried there. And so we've done oral history projects with First Nations elders, Chinese elders, and then the third significant cultural group was Indo-Canadian, primarily Sikh. And they came starting in the late 50s with this industrialization of the forest industry. So by the time I came, all the sort of pioneers of that community were reaching retirement age, and most of their children had, you know, gotten good educations and were had settled in the Lower Mainland. So when they reached retirement age, they were leaving the community. So we did a similar project trying to interview people and primarily filming in the temple and trying to collect artifacts to represent that community. All those things take time, right? Building relationships take time. So we've had a really nice donation from the Indo-Canadian community that represents a ladies dance group that was very active for 10, 15 years. But again, now it's sort of dying out because most of those ladies have retired and left the community. So when we did the original project, we did interviews and we got filming in the temple, but the artifacts that were donated were sort of your stereotypical Indian souvenirs. And now over time, we're gradually getting pieces that actually represent family stories and people in the community. And then we're also an archive, so doing a lot of oral histories. Another oral history project we did, the Canada 150 had an internship opportunity, and I really tried to focus on all the social groups, community groups that had developed since the centennial, since 67. You know, lots of our arts and environmental groups and the Women's Resource Center and all that kind of thing. They're often either volunteer run or a not-for-profit with a very small staff, and they're not well represented in our archives. So we tried to interview key members of those organizations and get their stories to have something to be a placeholder for them at this point.
When you were going about developing these oral history projects, were people in the community surprised to find the museum actively collecting stories of people that were alive and involved in the community?
We're owned by the municipality. A couple years before I arrived, they created a not-for-profit Friends of the Museum society, because otherwise we can't access any of the, you know, funding for arts and museums primarily. So one of their first projects was to start an oral history project and interview members of prominent families. And that has continued. So that Canada 150 project I told you about was a bit of a twist on that. What people offer to the museum and, you know, who people think we should be interviewing tends to be that older history. And so that idea of collecting, we're not doing contemporary collecting necessarily, but more recent history is worthy of being documented and collected, right? Rather than sitting and waiting for what people think we should have and bring in, we're trying to collect some of those gaps and find. And often the way we're doing it is an exhibit project, a funding project, to get the funding to go out and do the interviews and create some materials around.
How do you go about building your exhibition?
All different ways. I mean, so a lot of what I've been doing, you know, a lot of the projects that were done were driven from that strategic plan saying these are gaps, and we found different ways to try and fill them by doing an exhibit and getting funding and doing off. We've done a number of these video projects that collects material, but then also creates. So in many of our exhibits, we have a push screen or, you know, button video kiosk, or now we're using touch screens and editing short snippets out of those interview projects so that the people are telling their own stories in their own words. One of the other projects I'm doing is a collections review. So as you start to identify where things are missing, you sometimes create a project to encourage that, make people aware that that's something that we're interested in. And sometimes it does come from finding an artifact. I've got an exhibit that I've been working on, partly the Indo-Canadian community project was the Indo-Canadian community seeing their pioneers were losing and seeing what we'd done for some of these other cultural communities and saying, can we do that too? So when you get an invitation like that, you run with it. This other exhibit I'd like to do is from reviewing the collection. I found this birch bark roll with all these names on it when I just in pencil or pen, and when I started deciphering them, like the premier of the province, really an important ethnologist, and I'm thinking like, why are all these people at the Quesnel Hotel in 1930? Doing a little research on that. And at the same time, around the same time, we do projects. I'm the museum and heritage manager for the city, not just the museum curator. So we have artifacts scattered around the community and doing heritage plaquing and that type of thing. So we recognize that there were artifacts in parks around the community that were in disrepair, and I'd ended up getting a conservator in, making recommendations on how we should be caring, you know, what we should be doing for the various items around the community. And one of them is a water wheel that was installed in the early 1930s as a memorial to the pioneers of the Caribou Gold Rush. In the course of doing the research around that, I realized that all these individuals that I'd identified on the birch bark scroll, there had been an initiative to build a highway. And the premier and all these, you know, people involved with the Good Roads Movement had come through Quesnel, and they got as far, they went up as far as Hazleton. And so this was part of this push to build a road to Alaska in the 1930s, which obviously didn't happen then, but it's a sort of an interesting, the beginning of automotive tourism. And there's an example of a project that's come from things in our collection.
Have you found that the oral history projects that you've been doing, have they enriched the way that you look at the object collection of the museum?
They give you these personal stories and you get individuals telling it in their own voice. You know, particularly when you're trying to do First Nations history. And I mean, sometimes we can invite an elder in and have them telling their stories in their own voice for every visitor that comes through, I think is important. Sometimes we do interview people specifically who've donated things and get them to tell us more stories about them. But also it's often just filling in the gaps in the historic record.
Looking at the future of the Quesnel Museum, where do you see it in 5 years, 10 years? What are your thoughts and aspirations for it?
We're going to have another sit down and really think about what our priority projects are. I've talked already about strategic plan of the 2000s that identified, you know, broadening out in collecting more cultures and being more representative. The other big initiative that focus of that was that the facility, the lacks of the facility, and originally they did a feasibility study and develop plans for a whole new facility. And that was never practical. So we've stepped back and revisited, and we did a plan to renovate and try and use the existing footprint, but fill in some of the gap that we're missing in the existing facility. 2 or 3 years ago, we got funding and did more compressed storage in the archives so that we can collect more things. We've continued to do this collection assessment, so we're thinning out, so we also have more room to collect more things. We did enclose 2 outside exhibit areas and redevelop those exhibits. Last year, we cleared our back gallery and put new flooring down and reinstalled.
In these moves in the sort of assessments of the collection that you've been doing recently, that are kind of necessitated by these changes, have there been any sort of elements of the collection that you've been reacquainted with or that have surprised you or that you're looking at in a kind of a different way from the various projects you've done over the decade?
Well, when I arrived, the collections database, they had an access database, but it couldn't, you try and do a search and it would crash. It's really been, the deaccessioning has been a phased process as we do these little renovation chunks and or a specific project, and getting to know what we have, and then thinning down the number of multiples and trying to keep the things that have a good local provenance. I guess the other thing that's really spun and added to our knowledge of things is one of the first projects I did is get a grant and we digitized the local paper. So that really makes it easy to search, you know, when you find out you've got something and it belonged to this person, then you can do a search and find, you know, every baseball score they had growing up as a child. And so I mean, you have to wade through that, but you can sort of can create a synopsis of what their interests were. And that, again, also helps select.
What is your process in deaccessioning? What are some of the questions that are paramount to you in assessing duplicates? And that issue that seems to be, it's present in many regional museums of, you know, what stays and what goes.
When I came, the first thing I did is, you know, reviewed the collections policy and beefed up the deaccession process, and created a collections committee. So it's not me making decisions. Yeah. I have myself and my assistant, and then we have three. Originally, we had a Museum and Heritage Commission that was basically like our board of directors, and so we had representatives from that. So, and that was particularly important for me. I mean, it's a useful tool when people are offering things that they know it's not an arbitrary decision and it's not personal preference or anything. But also, particularly when I was new to the community, that helped me recognize what things had community connections and stories, right? And then what we're looking at is how many things we have, what are in good condition, and trying to get a representative sampling and evolution over time, and selecting down to try and make sure that there is some documented provenance. Another part of the process was to do some talk, you know, going to the Rotary and explaining what we were doing and doing some articles in the local paper. And if you explain what you're doing and why, it makes sense to everybody. And the other thing is that we also, if the donor is alive, we contact everybody. None of our things were given with a tax receipt. So we offer it back if we can.
What would you consider a highlight of the collection?
My background is in state of art. That's of interest to me as we've built up connections. We had quite a lot of things, but in the last couple of years, we've gotten things donated where we know who the maker was, often who it was made for. Some of those are highlights. I mentioned we have these two fantastic Chinese photographers, glass plate negatives from early 1900s to about 1920, probably most of them, that really show Quesnel as a multicultural community. Because they were a minority and were the professional photographers, they took the Caucasian community, they took all the Chinese community and the First Nations people. You've got, so it's that family portraiture, not ethnological. Another piece I think is really important is the first RCMP officer to challenge and wear a turban was stationed in Quesnel after his initial training, and was our community policing officer for a number of years. He donated one of his official turbans. So there's a story that people didn't know had any connection to Quesnel, but when they see it, older people will remember all the controversy over that, and it makes an interesting connection. And for the local Sikh community, I mean, he's not been here for quite a long time, but he's just an important figure and gives community pride to a lot of young men, I think, in the community.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you very much for taking the time to sit down with me, and we look forward to hearing new developments related to the Quesnel Museum.
Okay, thank you.